Now, as people gear up for 2020, there are a number of changes coming to the presidential nomination process. California bumped its primary day up to Super Tuesday in March, and last year the Democratic National Committee decided to drastically scale down the role of superdelegates. But there's another change that hasn't gotten as much attention that might have a big impact. At least four states that used a caucus system to nominate presidential candidates in 2016 will now use primaries instead. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, what are we hearing about which states are maybe making these changes and why they're doing it?
Well, so far it's Nebraska, Idaho, Minnesota, and Colorado. And I think the main motivation is that for quite some time now, people have been concerned about how few people actually participate in many of the caucuses around the country. So they really are pretty undemocratic in terms of just the few number of people who actually vote in a caucus. So, for example, in some of the lowest turnout states, Maine had about 6% turnout, so 64,000 people out of more than a million people actually participated in their caucuses, 5.5% in Kansas, 6% in Alaska, and under 5% in Hawaii. And so when you have, you know, around 5% of the voters in your state actually, you know, saying who the nominee should be for your party for president, that's really not a very representative process. Then when you put on top of it the other burdens placed on voters by caucuses in terms of the actual process where you have to go and often, you know, sit through a two-hour meeting before you can vote, and then something that maybe, you know, people who've never been in a caucus state may not even be aware of, it's not even a private vote. You vote publicly when you're in a caucus. You're in a large public space, usually like a high school gymnasium or something, and you're actually casting your vote in public because you go stand in a corner and caucus with the people who are supporting that candidate. And so all of your neighbors and all of the, you know, the people in the room can see who you're voting for. And so that is another thing that just makes a lot of people pretty uncomfortable about the caucus process. And so for those reasons, many states now are moving away from the caucuses and going with the more common primary selection process like we have in Wisconsin.
Now, do we know if a caucus versus a primary brings a different kind of voter into an election?
Yeah, it does, because the greater costs of participating make it so it's usually the more intense and the more involved and sometimes the more ideologically extreme voters who participate in the caucuses. So, for example, in the last round of caucuses and primaries, Bernie Sanders actually won 12 of the 18 caucuses, but he only won 11 of the 39 primary states. And so Bernie Sanders supporters, I think, were more intense, more ideologically extreme than Hillary Clinton supporters. And he ended up doing, you know, quite well, winning two-thirds of the caucus states, but not so well in the primary states where Clinton won a large majority of those. And so I think you do tend to see those more motivated voters who are the ones participating, because it is harder to participate than just simply going and casting your ballot in a primary.
Now, we have this kind of patchwork. We've got some states with caucuses, some states with primaries like we have in Wisconsin, where you can just show up as and register and vote in whichever party you want. We have other states, famously New York, where you have to be registered with the party months in advance.
Right.
Why do we have this patchwork of picking our Democratic and Republican presidential candidates?
Well, right. It's a really good point, Rob, that we really do have, it's, you know, at least, I don't know, probably 20, 25 different ways of selecting our delegates out of the 50 states. It's just an incredible patchwork across the states. And the reason that we have all of these variations is because the Constitution leaves the time, manner, and place regulation of elections up to the states. And so this is something that's dictated by our national Constitution, that states get to decide the actual process of how elections will be conducted. It's not a national something that the National Congress can do.
Talking to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the primary process, some states moving from caucus to primary leading up to the 2020 elections. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see when it comes to primaries or caucuses in the 2020 election? Do you think it makes a difference? And I'd love to hear in particular from our listeners over in Iowa who maybe have experienced a caucus firsthand. Can you tell us what that's like for those those of us who've never been in a caucus state. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. David, did the caucus system have kind of a rise and fall? Did it used to be even bigger than it is now?
Well, it's been fairly stable at somewhere, you know, around a dozen to, you know, up to, you know, 18 or so. It's been, you know, bouncing around between that level for the last 40, 50 years or so. And it was really the big change happened after 1972, where the McGovern-Fraser reforms were passed by the Democratic Party that kind of opened up the delegate selection process. And so a lot of states moved in the direction of primaries at that point. But since then, it's been, you know, a fairly even mix. About, you know, three quarters of the states are the primary states, and about a quarter are the caucus states. It's been, you know, fairly steady around that mix.
Now, a weird thing in American politics is we have the Constitution, as you mentioned. I'm pretty sure the Constitution doesn't say anything about political parties. And I've seen at least some historians, I can't think of a name right now, talk about the rise of parties as kind of a second constitution of American politics. And it gets weird when the party politics intersect with the original Constitution. Have we just kind of kludged a lot of this stuff together?
Well, right. You know, absolutely. The founders didn't anticipate political parties at all. I mean, they talked about parties as factions, because you certainly had the factions at the time of the founding of the Federalists, the Anti-Federalists, but you didn't have organized parties the way that you have now, especially in presidential politics. That's something they really didn't anticipate. And so the Electoral College itself had to be amended because of the way that they selected the president and vice president. The Electoral College didn't work once you threw political parties in, because you had the idea of the team ticket of the president and vice president was not anticipated by the founders at all. And so this was, you know, just a major problem that had to be resolved through a constitutional amendment. So you're absolutely right that the whole idea of partisan politics, and then this process we go through of how we, you know, nominate our candidates within the parties before the general election, is something that was not intended by the founders. And that's why we have this, you know, crazy quilt of all the different state regulations and rules that we have today, is because that's not something that was part of the original game plan.
Right. Under the original system, we'd have President Donald Trump and Vice President Hillary Clinton right now, right?
Well, absolutely. That's right. The top vote getter was president. The second vote getter would be vice president.
That'd be a fun cabinet meeting to sit in on.
That would be good.
Now, talking about the role of the nominating process, there's kind of a philosophical difference here in some ways. Is it that, okay, members of the party, participants in the party, should be involved in putting their candidate on a ballot, in which case maybe that caucus system sounds a little better? Or is it, no, this is a chance for the public to weigh in on who the candidate's going to be, then they weigh in again on the road, so that open primary makes a little more sense?
Well, right. I think the direction that most states are going is the latter, that this really should be a way for the public to weigh in and to have an open primary where it's, you know, it's the people getting to decide who the nominee should be for their party. But, you know, given that, you know, the political parties still are in charge of dictating the rules, you still do get the states that have, say, the closed primaries you mentioned, like in New York and a handful of other states, where you have to be a registered member of that party to participate in the primary, versus an open primary state like we have here in Wisconsin, where you don't have to be a registered Democrat or Republican to participate, you know, in the primary election. And then the caucus would be the highest level of that, you know, trying to keep it, you know, closed to the party members, although you can have both open and closed caucuses as well, just like you have open and closed primaries. So like I said, there are so many variations in how these elections are set up.
Now, some other news out there, South Carolina Republicans are considering not having a primary, and they're the first Southern primary usually, not having a primary at all to make a smoother path for their incumbent president. This has been done before for Ronald Reagan, I think, and George W. Bush, I think I read. Is this something we see very often, a party saying, yeah, we'll just skip it this year?
It's not very common, but you're right. It has happened before, especially, you know, in the party where you have an incumbent president and you want to try to minimize any potential infighting you could have within the party. So we don't have any prominent candidate yet who has announced they'd be running against Donald Trump to challenge him for the nomination in 2020. But someone like John Kasich is being mentioned, and there are others as well who could potentially emerge as a challenger to Donald Trump. So one thing that sometimes state parties will do is try to head that off by just saying, oh, yeah, we'll just sit this one out.
We're talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, with us to talk about the caucus system in American presidential politics versus primaries. At least four states are switching. They had caucuses in 2016. They're doing primaries next time around. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a preference? Do you like the way we do the primary election here in Wisconsin? What do you think of caucuses? Have you ever participated in one? Maybe you're listening in Iowa right now. Love to hear from you. How do you think changes will affect the primaries for president? What do you think of the idea of Democrats getting rid of super delegates, or at least downplaying their role? I'm not sure exactly how that all shook out. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how we nominate our candidates for president. At least four states are getting rid of their caucuses and moving to primaries instead. David Cannon is with us. He's a political scientist from UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you fall on the caucus versus primary debate? How do you think states should do this? Should we all do it the same? I'm not sure what it would take to make that happen, but maybe. And have you voted in a caucus yourself? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. David is with us in Prairie du Chien. David, hi.
Hi, thank you. I used to live in Iowa. I attended many caucuses. I was actually a congressional candidate a number of years ago in Iowa. But with respect to the idea of a caucus, one of the weaknesses of a caucus, if I might quickly note, is that in any given precinct, it depends on the number of, in this instance, Democrats who would show up, for example. So if 20 Democrats showed up in a precinct, each candidate wouldn't even be counted as having any support if they didn't reach the 10% threshold at the first round of gathering as to who favors whom. So if there were 100 people there, if you had 9 people for candidate X, it would be reported out later that that candidate had...
I think we lost you, David. Yep, I think we lost David, but thanks a lot for that call. And, yeah, that's another wrinkle in the caucus system, David,
right.
That threshold rule.
It is, and it actually, I'm glad David raised that point, because it's another very odd thing about the caucus, how it works, is that once the candidate doesn't reach that threshold, let's say that, take his example of the 9 people who voted for someone on that first round, but they don't hit that 10% threshold, they actually get a chance then to vote again on the next round. And I've never attended a caucus myself, but I've talked to a lot of people who have, and they say it's almost like a rugby scrum at that point, where the supporters for the other candidates come over and say, come on, support us, and they're like pulling on their arms, trying to get them to come over to their corner. And so it is this like open, contested process of trying to attract the votes then to the candidates who are still remaining who did hit that 10% threshold. And so that process then of having it not be a private vote is something that does make a lot of people uncomfortable, because we normally think of our voting as something that's a very private act. Like, you don't want to have everyone know who you voted for, but a caucus is entirely open and public.
All right. Thanks for that call. Now, David, we've got a phone line packed with people who have lived or live in Iowa. So I'm going to get through a few of them now, and then we'll come back to you. We'll go to Eric with us now in Middleton. Eric, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've lived on both sides of the river several times. I actually grew up in Iowa and grew up going to caucuses when I was just a little kid. And I guess that points to what I perceive as one of the big advantages of the caucus is it's a family event. It's very participatory. People do talk to each other and try to convince each other of the other candidates. I go there not ready to vote. I go there sometimes willing to listen to other people who have looked at the issues and looked at the candidates. It's an event of democracy, not just a final go into a booth and on your own make your vote. there's another piece to it that, don't forget, this is a the caucus is a party building event, and you know, resolutions come out of that same caucus event. That's where decisions are made about what does the party stand for. And during my times in Wisconsin, I'm back in Wisconsin now, I've never figured out how that happened. It seems like the parties come down to the candidates, at least from the perception as a voter. It's just candidates here, candidates there. Their party practically doesn't exist. You don't even have to declare a party.
All right, let's go to, thank you for that call, Eric. Interesting insight into that. Marty, now on the other side of that river in Dubuque. Marty, hi. Marty, are you there? That's Marty gone. I think Jeff is with us now in Green Bay. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, just to reiterate the previous caller's comment, I participated in three caucuses as a bachelor's and master's student at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And I loved how you could help establish the platform. I was very active in the mid-'80s in getting something in the Democratic platform to get government to divest from South Africa when they were practicing apartheid, and that was a very exciting thing for me. And I wish we had that opportunity in Wisconsin to shape the platform of our parties a little more.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. We'll go now to Tom in Waukon, Iowa. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What do you think about caucuses?
I love them. Came from Minnesota, got down to Iowa. It forces the candidates for governor or for president even to come to a small local place. I met Mrs. Obama in the library in Waukon. And I met the former governor of Wisconsin in a bar in Waukon. It is democracy, and it says that, you know, people are important. I love it.
Tom, thanks a lot. All right, thanks to all our callers. All right, David, we've had a hard sell here for caucuses. People who have participated in them love them. It's participation. It makes the candidates actually come out and talk to people.
Well, yeah, but Iowa, we have to remember, is distinctive in terms of their place in the primary selection process, the candidate selection process. They're first. And so the fact that Iowa is the first caucus and then New Hampshire is the first primary, Iowa gets a huge amount of attention that these other caucus states don't get. So if you're in Hawaii or Nebraska or Colorado, you're not getting that same kind of attention from every other candidate who comes to Iowa for months and months and months before the caucus. And so Iowa is really quite distinctive in that regard. Now, on the other hand, Iowa is similar to other caucus states in the points that Eric and Marty and some of the others raised about how you do have the opportunity to help shape the party platform. That's true. That's a huge advantage in terms of Democratic participation to have that kind of broader participation at that level. But it's also then a disincentive to the more casual voter, the one that just wants to go in and vote and, you know, not have to sit through a two-hour party meeting. And that's why you get these really low participation rates in so many states of 5-6% of voters, you know, bothering to turn out and participate in a caucus. So it's great for the people who are the party activists and the ones who want to be involved. It does give them a easier vehicle for getting involved and participating. But that same advantage for, like, the folks who are calling in is a huge obstacle to people who just want to have their voice heard in terms of who they're supporting for the presidential nominee in their party.
Now, one of our Iowans who called said, hey, in your non-caucus states, you know, people aren't involved in the parties. What even are the parties if people don't have to register to vote either way? Is there something to that?
Well, I mean, we do have our state party conventions in Wisconsin, and most other, you know, primary states will have those, where people who do want to get involved can participate in their political parties, you know, both at the local level and at the state level. So we do have similar mechanisms. It's just that they don't get as much attention because they're not the vehicle for selecting the nominee for their party. And so those institutions exist, but, yeah, they're much more in the background, not as prominent as they would be in a caucus state.
Now, when it comes to changes, getting back to the big picture, David, changes in how parties nominate their presidents, are they always fighting the last campaign in some ways, figuring out what went wrong or what people didn't like in the last one, changing it until somebody figures out how to exploit the new rules, then they change it again?
Well, right. I think that is a good insight. I think that's exactly what is happening in some of the changes this time around. Like, for example, downplaying the role of superdelegates you mentioned before. That's something that the Sanders supporters were really upset that Hillary Clinton had such a huge majority of the superdelegates. So one thing that the Democratic Party did this time around for 2020 is to really downplay that role of the superdelegates by not allowing them to vote on the first ballot at all. So it's just going to be the pledged delegates from the primaries and caucuses who will be determining who the nominee will be, not the superdelegates. The only way the superdelegates would come into play would be if you had a deadlock convention. And so that's a pretty big concession to the Sanders supporters, and indeed any kind of outsider candidate who's not the pick of the insiders, because those superdelegates, those are the true party insiders. They're the elected party officials, the state party leaders, and they're the ones that were overwhelmingly supporting Hillary Clinton. And so that's a pretty big change to say we're going to take away their power on the first ballot now.
We'll leave it there for now, David, but I'm sure we'll talk to you a time or two before 2020 rolls around.
Absolutely.
That's David Cannon, political science professor from UW-Madison, with us to talk about why a number of states that use the caucus system in the 2016 primaries are moving to actual primaries ahead of 2020.